Hi everyone! Left to our own devices, the conference may be over, but you can still watch the recording at cybellum.com/conference. Tune in to listen to FDA updates from FDA executives themselves, learn about AI in automotive from NVIDIA, the AI leader, and listen to product security leaders from Philips, Honeywell, CISA, and more. Go to cybellum.com/conference and watch the recording for free. See you at the next event!
Hi, this is David.
And this is Shlomi.
And you've tuned into Left to Our Own Devices,
the Product Security Podcast.
So our guest today is Miral Sahik, Global VP and GM of Cybersecurity at Honeywell. Miral has spent over a decade embedded across various domains with global experience leading engineering, operations, marketing, and sales teams. He's an advisor and board member in multiple cybersecurity organizations and nonprofits, and is really one of the trailblazers in the world of IT and OT cybersecurity. We are really thrilled to have him on the show today. Miral, welcome to Left to Our Own Devices.
Thank you so much for having me on, Shlomi and David. It's an honor and a privilege.
It's definitely an honor for us to have you. So it would be really great if you could share with our listeners how you made your way from being a lecturer in Deakin University down under to the position of VP and GM of cybersecurity for one of the largest multinational conglomerates in the world.
Appreciate the question. It's interesting, if I may, after completing my engineering degree, you know, I majored in mechatronics. I specialized in robotics. I also did a science degree where I did mathematical modeling. So very, very academic focus. It was to lead me into further studies at university. So I was ready to go and do my PhD. So I was going to stay at the university. I love the culture, learning, exploring. To me, it all made sense. However, at the same time, I had some friends working in industry, and I think hearing their stories, the stories from the field, it kind of ignited a different sense of adventure for me. And I think this yearning for adventure is what really moved me out of academia and into industry. And look, from there, I mean, I've been across, as you mentioned, critical infrastructure in some way, shape or form for 12, 13 years, starting in control systems engineering and working mainly in heavy industry. So think about refining, gas processing, chemical, mining. And this is really where I cut my teeth on things like the process control environment. You know, these SCADA systems that we hear about, these PLCs that control the valves and the pumps, the DCS system, the manufacturing execution system, the advanced process control, all of these elements that make up these processing facilities, these critical infrastructure facilities. It was all very technical and fascinating stuff. I mean, woke up every morning, I got to solve customer problems with these great solutions. So it was very well worth it. I learned a ton. And, you know, I remember this story. I've told it many times, but one of the most beautiful memories out in the field was I got sent out. Actually, I put my hand up and on a big project out in an oil rig. So it's a floating platform in the middle of the ocean. So you're out there, you fly over with a helicopter and you begin your work and you're overlooking this ocean. So as far as the eye can see, and I was working on a new flare stack implementation and doing this work, this very technical work in this beautiful remote place. It's what it was, to me, it's what dreams were made of, and certainly fun times. So all these great adventures and working with some great teams, customers. There was a theme that started to creep up, at least in this heavy industry space, and it was that our customers wanted more of a single point of ownership around these industrial control environments. So think about everything I just spoke about, the DCS, RTU, PLC, all this stuff, as well as the ICT, and I know I'm throwing a lot of acronyms at here, but ICT is basically your compute, your virtualization, your storage. They wanted all this centralized on the one team. This is, to me, very exciting because I'd worked across many of these different facets and it really piqued my interest. And at the time, I was working in our process group, our PMT group, and about, I'd say, 6 or so years ago, I joined our building technologies business. So you can think about this business as very, very similar to the heavy industry, but instead of a DCS, we have something called a BMS. So building management system. That's the single point of control. That includes everything from access control, digital security, video, your lift system, all these great things. It controls anything and everything in a facility. So very, very similar, but different ways to describe them. So after I moved into this building space, I quickly realized this single point of ownership that I was just talking about, that was also a major theme in the building side. So I guess in summary, the last 6 years, 3 of those years were, how do we build this discipline within our business to help our customers solve this convergence of ICT and bring in this new topic, because it's a very, very new topic of cybersecurity for operational technology. So that's me in the last 6 years. You know, I get to wake up every day, educate our customers, think about great solutions to solve their challenges in this evolving space for operational technology and cybersecurity. Fascinating stuff.
So in other words, how do I keep saving the world on a daily basis?
Well, the good news is it's not just me. If it were just up to me, we'd be in a little bit of trouble. We've got a great, great team, you know, absolutely working hand in hand with our customers to solve those challenges.
Sounds like a one-of-a-kind gig for sure. So I'm very interested actually about a post you posted recently. You shared a survey that showed that 93% of cyber leaders and I think 86% of cyber business leaders believe that the geopolitical instability makes really a catastrophic cyber event likely in the next 2 years. So that's alarming. And you asked the readers what they thought. I'm curious, what do you think?
When it comes to cybersecurity, it's such a mysterious topic, and I'm sure we can get into the mystery a little bit later on. So what I like to do when it comes to statistics, I think I reflect upon some of the insights we can gather in our industry. And, you know, we did a survey that focused specifically on our industry, so buildings, OT, and the threats and the emerging threats in this space. And I think we received a great set of responses from senior leaders in these industries, and 27% of the respondents said that they already have had some cyber breach in their OT systems in the last 12 months. So that's one data point, which I found quite interesting. And
wow, scary.
And to me, that's fascinating because you don't hear about it as much as you may some of the other challenges that we're facing. And I think we had roughly less than half, maybe 44% of these respondents say that they had some level of understanding of cybersecurity, meaning they had some protection in play, not the entire suite that they need, but maybe something, which is very alarming, because it means the other, you know, 50-60% haven't yet started that journey. So if I break this down, I think when we talk about these cyber events and we talk about critical infrastructure, I mean, just to give you some perspective, we see everything from data breaches. So this includes exfiltration of data, so people taking data that isn't theirs. That includes personally identifiable information as well. We've seen ransomware attacks. These things are particularly important to prevent against in these industries because they cause disruption of service. So think about, you know, if you're in a building and you have a ransomware attack, you've now lost door access. You've lost access to your security feeds. Now, if it's a standard premium commercial building, you may say, okay, I need to fix that right away. But what if it was a hospital? You know, what if it was a data center? So we start to really come up with these interesting cases where we really want to protect and prevent some of these challenges. So, and we've seen other things like carjacking, people taking your card, cloning it, walking into places that they shouldn't be. So I think overall, the challenge is real. We see many incidents. We see our responders of this survey. They have had incidents. As I mentioned, some of these are public, some of these are not. You know, I've talked about hospitals. The challenge with hospitals in particular is if we do have some type of incident, they could lead to a loss of life. And I'm not saying that to be dramatic. In certain circumstances, We've seen that happen as well. So I think the grander scale of cybersecurity and how it impacts us as patrons and certain users of these services is very, very real. So I think back to your question, ultimately, these incidents from whichever lens of instability we view them as, they're not slowing down. We see that. And I think we just need to be proactive in the way we approach mitigating and preventing some of these incidents.
Yeah, it's really scary when you think about, like, for example, you mentioned oil and gas rigs. Mm-hmm. The control systems that measure the pressure, for example, and if somebody hacks into that, they can, you know, explode the rig basically from somewhere offsite, or the flow of water and how much the various chemicals that are being added into the water system, or even just the flow of water itself. I mean, mm-hmm. yeah, there are so many different ways that a hacker could really, you know, cause damage. And we've seen it, let's say, as you said, it's not being reported. And I don't think all of them are being reported. So it's definitely something that we really have to, as you said, mitigate the risk and keep our eyes on. So we've seen that today companies in the industrial sector have focused a lot on IT cybersecurity and OT network security as their primary focus, and maybe a bit less on, or maybe a lot less, on the security of the devices and products and control systems themselves. Has this been your view as well? And if so, do you see this changing at this point or any point in the near future?
Absolutely. It's my view. And yes, I do see it changing. But let's take a journey through time here. And maybe I'll throw a few acronyms out there again, but stay with me. And let's focus in the context of buildings, because that's something everyone's familiar with, right? So, you know, buildings are all around us. And every building that you enter, just so we're clear, they all have some level of automation. So the thing that I spoke about earlier, the building management system, that's dedicated to piecing all the pieces together to allow for that automation. So, but not every building is the same. As I mentioned, we have premium commercial, we have data centers, we have hospitals, we have the universities, we have airports, we have federal facilities, we have correctional facilities, and we have these amalgamation of buildings we call smart cities and smart campuses. So when I say building, just do know that each of them could be different, but the general premise is the same. There's some level of automation, some level of controlling and monitoring for these mechanical and electrical systems that will actuate something down the line, right? So this could be HVAC, lighting, access control, fire, digital security. These are the typical things we think about. In a hospital, it could be the nurse call system. It could be the real-time location system. In a smart city, it could be the environmental sensors, the traffic management system. So all of these have underlying controls. And I think, David, to your point, if you are able to influence these PLCs, these controllers, if you're able to talk on these open protocols, Ethernet IP, Modbus, BACnet, you could potentially do some damage, right? So the BMS is at the center of all of these systems, and they're interdependent. We have the ICT system on top, the controllers, the servers, the workstations, the network systems. All of these, think about it as a beautifully crafted web that's meant to work together to give you the right result. Now, these systems, they should, if we want to be cyber secure, sit in what we call a segmented network. And typically, this is the ISA 99 or the Purdue model, where everything is nicely segmented. And the reason for this, if one area of the network is impacted, it won't take down the other network and vice versa. So I'm overly simplifying here, but you have this very, very tightly coupled, segregated, separated network. We don't have that in most of the areas today. We have flat networks. So what does this lead us to? Well, we've got flat networks. We've got a lot of systems talking on these networks. Some are dated, some are fairly new, and some are bleeding edge new. Now, think about IoT, think about edge devices, all these things. Now, all of these systems have started to talk to each other. So that's new. That wasn't really the case in the past. Systems are now talking, to other systems that weren't sharing data. These systems are also talking to the edge devices and back down. They're talking from the device level to the cloud, or from the device level to the edge to the cloud. So a lot of connectivity. And if you think about, I guess the biggest challenge here is we're digitizing, we're moving to a connected world, an interoperable world, but we maybe haven't stopped and said, hold on a second, all these legacy systems, maybe they weren't designed to operate in this type of form and function. Maybe we need to go back and think about, what is my cybersecurity posture of system A? How do I take my network from a flat to a segmented purview model? What does it mean to do a hardening of my systems? Do I need to monitor these systems? So I think the biggest challenge the industry is facing today is education and how to educate. So you know, this is why discussions like this are so vital, in my opinion, because we're educating. So I do believe that we are going through this change. I do believe we are getting better as practitioners are out there educating. But education is the only way to make this real change.
Right.
Hopefully that helps provide some clarity. And maybe you've got some other questions as a result of that. I don't know, but happy to.
Yeah, we sure do. I think in our little corner of the world, this reminded me of the reason why we even started this podcast, because we simply saw that there is no place for people in this field of product security to share their knowledge and insights. None. Like it's basically, you may know some friends or colleagues, but that's it. And it seemed like such an important topic to talk about that we had to do something. But yeah, completely agree. And it's something, by the way, we hear from so many experts all the time. Mm-hmm. Education, even more so than technology, more so than other things. So I actually have a question. Maybe you just answered it, but what do you think is the greatest challenge today in ensuring that critical infrastructure customers of Honeywell's or others are protected against a major attack, if one does occur, or that their response will be quick and thorough if that happens?
Yeah, thanks, Slimy. Look, let's go deeper, right? So as you mentioned, and as we just talked about, once we have a foundational level of understanding, so we know that we need to improve, I think the next steps are really to simplify this as much as possible. So we need to simplify this critical infrastructure cybersecurity strategy. So like all things, we start by breaking items down into the various constituents and we prioritize based on the applicability of that specific thing to the environment. This is very key because not everything that is applicable for one environment, for example, I talked about a hospital, is applicable for another environment. Another example, we talked about the oil refinery. Differences of perspective, differences of approach, differences of threat and vulnerability management. So this all sounds great, right? But how do we go about doing this? How do we make it practical to all the business stakeholders involved? And I'll emphasize the word business, because that's what we need to do. So I think cybersecurity is a difficult conversation to have because it's shrouded in mystery. And I think the better we simplify and synthesize our messaging to remove any jargon, and I think some level of abbreviation is fine. And I think as I've gone through here and I've given you a lot of acronyms, that's also fine. But how do we demystify that and make it simple? Make it practical for the CEO, the CFO, the CRO, others that are just figuring out what cybersecurity means for their business, right? So I think where we see our clients get value is with what we call our risk-based road mapping approach. And I get it. Maybe some listeners may think, okay, risk-based and say, how do you quantify risk? You cannot quantify risk in this industry. It's too difficult. We've tried. Look, I'll tell you, it's possible. And not only that it's possible, it's practical. It's one of the only ways to really drive a result. So, and it all comes back down to simplification, synthesization of that specific area for your business and applying the right model. So when we work with our clients, it's really to understand this risk appetite. We call it risk appetite. It's an industry term as well. So how much risk that business is willing to take based on their operating framework and their budget. Right? We can have the best cybersecurity practices, but no budget to implement these practices. So really, when we build out this program, just to round this out, I mean, for example, in certain critical infrastructure environments with a higher risk appetite and minimal budget, we will potentially have a program that only includes a few things, a few layers of protection, but never zero, just a few, because they're willing to accept risk and their budget is low. Whereas the opposite is also true, where certain clients have a low risk appetite and their willingness to pay in their budgets higher. We would include more layers of protection. And maybe yourselves and many of your listeners, they think about this and they say, aha, that is a defense in depth approach. That's exactly right. So we marry this risk-based quantification, which gets us our outcome from a budgetary perspective, to the actual defense in depth model. Right? So just some typical layers. I talked about the risk and asset gap analysis. We talked about hardening briefly, network segmentation, disaster recovery, monitoring, patch management, incident reporting, readiness, advisory, all these good things we try to map out in this framework. That's the goal. So I guess to summarize, to make it simple, take the first step, marry the business risk with the business context, which includes a budget, and this will drive the cyber maturity roadmapping program. And we've seen this be successful, and I'm sure we can make it work across multiple industries.
Interesting. So I have to tell you, it brings back a memory of mine. When I first started out after university, I was working for probably the biggest or the most important investment bank on Wall Street. Mm. And we were moving our network communications and security operation from New York to New Jersey. We had triple backup. We had a twisted pair. We had microwave and we had fiber optics. So we had just about everything that you would need, because the money that was running across the lines was in the multi-millions every day. And then we finished that project, and also the security, you know, at that bank was tripleized, and we had to do it on every single mechanism. And following that project, I moved out to Los Angeles and I worked for a government contractor. And there we had fiber optic only. And I said, well, what happens if, you know, if there's a breach, what happens if, you know, something goes wrong, where are the backups? And they said, well, you know, we're different than a bank. You know, if we have to shut down for a couple of weeks, you know, we have the Pacific Ocean here and we can go boogie boarding. No, they didn't say that, but I could read the underlying, you know, the underlying meaning was that it's not as critical. And when you talk about the business risk factor, there was no question that the bank took it a lot differently. I don't want to say more seriously, but mm-hmm. a lot differently than the government contractor.
It's a great point, right? And even in that case you described, they still had some notion that they needed to protect the fiber optic. It's never zero, right? You cannot drive right. it down to zero. There's always some level of risk there and some level of risk you want to mitigate against. So yeah,
absolutely.
Great example.
Yeah, it brings me back a few years. So there's been a lot of talk of late, you know, because of the executive order that had come out, and most recently the omnibus bill about SBOMs and supply chain security in the world of product and device cybersecurity. So can you share with us where you see the whole area of SBOMs going in the coming years? You know, will end customers demand or acquire them for their own compliance? Will you be requesting or requiring that your suppliers will provide those to you as you integrate the different components, you know, for the end customers?
You know, it's a great topic of discussion, and leading on from our recent panel as well, right, David? I think the software bill of materials, yeah, this concept's been around for a while. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, more than 10 years, right? We have.
Yeah, at least.
Yeah.
Yep.
Software package data exchange, the open standard. So I think the concept behind this machine-readable inventory of components, dependencies, the metadata, the relationships, all of this stuff, as the SBOM quantifies, that's not going away. So why isn't that going away? Well, just if we think about it, a huge majority of the applications we use today contain some element of open source code, right? So this open source code is created anywhere from a very dedicated, very committed, very methodical group of independent contributors that are actively updating the repos and doing all this great stuff, all the way through to one person managing the repo, rarely checking in. They do the initial commit and that's it, right? So there's a huge disparity in the open source code side of things. But again, it's open source for a reason, and it's great that we have that community. So, you know, we're left with this perfect dynamic of events. So open source software that is provided to you as is, right? There's no guarantees in open source software. It's provided as is used across many product architectures. And then if there's a vulnerability, well, what happens? What happens is there's a vulnerability in the open source side. Where is it used? What do we do? And this, again, is why SBOMs are important. It lets us know what actually goes into the actual product. So I think it's wise to request this level of detail. It helps us improve the fidelity, right? That's what it's all about. And I know most of us think about the SBOM in a similar way to, I think, David, you mentioned it, to an ingredient list that you see on the back of your favorite food, right? So right. If we were to pair this software ingredient list with active vulnerability databases, then we get our nutritional value for our product, right? So, and as we know, too many vulnerabilities is just as bad as having too much sugar in your diet. So these vulnerabilities, I want to stress, the vulnerabilities need to be mapped to your business context and your environment. Not every vulnerability means code red. It needs to be mapped to your business context, right? So I think systematically addressing these vulnerabilities that are relevant to the business and using these integrated SBOMs is really just, it's a standout way to reduce your exploitability, your overall threat footprint.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the issues that people talk about when they talk about SBOMs. How do you turn it into actual exploitability that connects to the business and the risk? There are a lot of discussion around that lately. So actually, if I can go back to a personal question, you mentioned before the, you know, your amazing opportunity to fly over the ocean with amazing views as far as the eye can see. So maybe that's the answer to my next question. But if not, we're really curious to know what's the most incredible or unbelievable moment you had in your career so far that really influenced you and your career or your personal life.
Yeah, look, we were talking a little bit about the importance of culture and the importance of getting involved before we went live. But I've been very blessed to work with some of the most talented people, you know, everyone from engineering, ops, marketing, business dev. And I think, you know, most of these days, and most of us, we're all global citizens, so we tend to travel a lot, right? David, you're now in Miami. Shlomi, you're in Tel Aviv. So I'm here in Atlanta. We're constantly traveling. And, you know, when I first started traveling, it was more globally, it was really airport, hotel, meeting, hotel, airport. And that sounds, right, maybe to some, it sounds very, very commonplace. It's what they're doing today. And it may be very productive, but it didn't really, for me anyway, it didn't expand my horizons, except for, you know, understanding which hotel chain has the best breakfast in which city. It didn't really do much else there for me. But I think over time, one of the definitive changes for me that I saw here was I made sure that within my itinerary, there was some level of personal time devoted to immersing yourself in whatever region I'm in into their culture. So taking 2-3 hours in the afternoon, right, after dinner or early in the morning, if it means, you know, waking up at 4 a.m. to trek to a temple in East India to watch the sunrise, do it. There's really these experiences, these cultural integration experiences are just, you cannot put a value on it. It's just incredible. It helps you build an understanding of the various cultures, the people you work with. It helps develop deeper, truer connections with your peers as well. I think this small tweak, going from airport, hotel, meeting, hotel, airport, to just still doing the necessary and taking a few hours to seeing what's out there in the culture, has just been, honestly, groundbreaking for me.
Right. Such good advice. Thanks.
Yeah, it really is. And I think one of the other thing it really provides, when you tell the people, the local people, that you're interested in seeing, you know, different areas, different sites, different things in their country, they really enjoy hearing that. And they, a lot of times they'll come with you or they'll arrange it for you and they'll give you other ideas of where to go.
Yeah,
definitely. And actually my last trip to Nepal last year, I was on pleasure, but I also got up at 4 a.m. to go see sunrise. It was a sunrise over like 4 of the main Himalayan mountains. Yeah. So yeah, it was pretty incredible. But also I remember my first trip to India, and same thing as you, I wanted to see some of the local sites, and you know, it definitely has an impact on the people you're working with.
Yeah, and it helps you grow, right? I mean, you get to experience the culture and the country, and it's priceless.
Yeah, and the other benefits are that when you come back for pleasure, you have those local contacts already, and so many times I've met up with, you know, old friends and people that I've met over the years in different countries, just about anywhere in the world, and I'm sure you've had the same experience, and definitely great. So maybe you can provide us with 3 tips for security teams on how they should be preparing for 2023 going forward, and where they should focus their efforts.
Yeah, look, I think 2023 is, it's been a year of grounding. So a year of going back to the fundamentals. At least it will be, in my opinion. So the 3 tips that I can offer, and they, at least in my mind, can be used sequentially across more than just cybersecurity, but let's stick with that lens. So number one is quantify. So break out your architecture diagrams, map out the interfacing systems, the relevant vendors, figure out your cybersecurity posture as it relates to your current business operations. I think this first quantification step is super, super critical. It's important as it allows us to actually make a start from a point of clarity. We're not just adding building blocks to a rocky foundation. So quantify is my number one. I think number two, it's simplify. So anyone that's worked with me and continues to work with me, I'm all about simplification, making the complex simple, breaking it out into smaller chunks, making it something we can tackle as a team, as individuals. So let simplification be your goal with all these things. So determine what is actually relevant to the operational benefit of your business. Again, going back to business context first. And the amount of risk attributed to each of these items going forward. So think about this as your future state. If I know this is the amount of risk I have in my business today, and I've quantified it to this simple input, and I feel as though the business is going to do XYZ to grow into the future, well, okay, I'm going to grow with it. I've done my quantification, done my simplification. I'm going to grow with it. And then I've got this kind of simple way of framing it. Your tasks should be almost put into 3 buckets. Abandon, so things you're going to stop doing, right? Develop, things you're going to nurture and things that you've started that are going in the right direction. And then innovate. And these are the new things you're going to do to help the business grow. So quantify, simplify, and then third, you've got to own it. So third is around ownership and accountability. So I think accountability is critical to actually moving forward with these transformative initiatives. You know, ownership, we forget this, but ownership drives our sense of urgency. Without it, we can say, yeah, we'll have a meeting every week. If there's no ownership, where does the urgency come from, right? So it allows these business benefits to be realized a lot quicker. So I think we need to hold ourselves to account. We need to hold others to account. And what we call our say-do ratio, I'm going to say this, I'm going to do that, they need to be one-to-one. They need to be high. So I think these intentionally simple 3 tips, at least for me, continue to be the principles by which I move forward.
And it's interesting that you said these 3 relatively simple tips, but meanwhile, you're the vice president and general manager of cybersecurity for Honeywell. So I think it's probably when you're looking at the size of such a large organization, it's incredible that these are the tips and that these are the things that work. And I think I definitely agree with you. Accountability and taking things on and seeing them through to the end. I think you're right, 100%, and very interesting.
Yeah, look, most things can be quantified because you're doing them for a reason. Most things can be simplified. And once all that is done, you're doing the things for a reason that are simple, that you own or someone else owns, that's going to help you drive the outcome. It's right. I think just whether it's in business or in personal life, these three things, it help you stay focused as well.
Yep.
So you're following your own tips, I see. So after you said that all we need to do is simplify, you just simplified it perfectly for us. this is great. So maybe one final question, Miral. We know that you're actively involved in a few cybersecurity organizations and nonprofits. Is there anything you'd like to share about this activity or anything else for that matter?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, again, it goes back to accountability and the ownership point. So I think we, as leaders in the industry, we're always looking for causes that we feel strongly about and can contribute to. I mean, again, look at the great work you two are doing with this podcast. You saw a gap, you saw a need, you saw that we need to educate, and you went and created. That's fantastic. So I think I'm trying to do something similar with some of these organizations. And one of them, an organization I work with called Building Cybersecurity, or BCS, one of their core mission statements is really to draw on this cross-domain experience to create a framework for these cyber-physical OT systems that we just talked about. So what is that framework? How do you assess against it? Bronze, silver, gold, platinum, where do I need to be? We've done a lot of work around this, and I think a lot of great progress in establishing this framework, and that's going to continue. So definitely check out bcs.org. Similarly with the World Economic Forum, the WEF, part of their Cyber Resilience Task Force, and this is more leaning into creating frameworks that are overarching for critical infrastructure such as smart cities. You can see some of the great work we've done there as well. But another organization that may be outside of frameworks and something I'm very committed to is the Global Center for Cybersecurity, or GCC. And now GCC was founded on two intersections, two issues that are facing today in cybersecurity. So one, there's not enough people working in cyber to meet the growing threats that we all face, and this is at a global level. And two, there are organizational challenges that prevent or slow down this process of hiring the right cybersecurity people in these roles. I think we may have all faced those challenges at some point in our careers. So I think at GCC, look, we look at it from a diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging lens, work across communities, foster workforce development, collaboration, innovation, and bring all that goodness into the cybersecurity industry. So I think just succinctly there, trying to build bridges between a candidate and connect them to prospective employers. And these candidates typically from a historically siloed or excluded minority. So we bring this collective into this non-for-profit, and the understanding is really to make sure that we're fostering growth across the right industries that need it and the people that will benefit from serving that industry. Now, again, encourage everyone to check out BCS, Building Cybersecurity, GCC, Global Center for Cybersecurity, and the World Economic Forum Cyber Resilience Task Force website. I'm not sure if we can drop some links in, but we may be able to do that in wherever we post this. And also, if you're interested in cybersecurity and further education, you can come hear me lecture at Washington University. Great university with a great executive cyber program. I'll be doing that as an adjunct professor as well. So very much appreciate the time today. Thank you so much, Shlomi and David.
Thank you, Miral, really for a fascinating conversation. And all we can say is keep doing what you're doing and push this industry forward. And I personally hope you'll have many more flights over the ocean.
and a lot more enjoyment on the visits.
Yeah. Well, when I'm in Israel next, I think you two gentlemen will be showing me the good sights for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You can bet on it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. It was great having you.
Left to Our Own Devices is brought to you by Cybellum. To learn more, visit cybellum.com.